We have with us Dr. Garth Nicholson. Dr. Nicholson was a tenured professor at MB Anderson Clinic in Texas, and, well, he began looking into the background of mycoplasma. There was a problem at a place called Huntsville in Texas where there in the prison a lot of people had apparently gotten quite ill, and then the illness had spread into the community, and the guards got it, and then their families got it, and there was an inordinate number of people with ALS and MS and other degenerative neurological diseases. And as Dr. Nicholson began looking deeper and deeper into the possible involvement of a mycoplasm, a genetically altered mycoplasm in the community, why, he ran afoul of some very powerful people who didn't want that information out. So fortunately, he has moved to California. At least he's here, where at least people in California can share in his knowledge. He's written well over 500 and, well, at least 525 peer-reviewed articles. He's been the editor of a number of prestigious scientific magazines. And are you still editing a couple of those yourself?
Yes, sir. We're dealing with a number of different journals, and I was just appointed one of the associate editors of the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome in this last few weeks. So taking up more duties, actually.
Well, why don't you just sort of fill our listeners in? The average individual has never heard of a mycoplasm. They've never heard of any of these things being genetically altered or anyway altered. Could you explain to them what this is really all about, how you got involved in this, and, of course, what you are finding through your research?
Well, I'd be happy to, and I'll start by saying that about an hour ago we got a telephone call from one of our former patients, actually an entire family, that was in Huntsville, Alabama, and actually the male member of the family was in a leadership role in one of the units, one of the Huntsville prison units in Texas, and he had a family whose daughter was diagnosed with ALS, and of course members of the family got sick. They came to us because we were working with Gulf War veterans who were showing many of the same symptoms, and of course there's an alarming rate of ALS in Gulf War veterans, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. But the daughter of this family was given essentially a death sentence at Baylor College of Medicine. She was told that she probably wouldn't live more than a few more years, and she was a teenager at the time. Now, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, as it's called, is a neurodegenerative disease that's almost uniformly fatal. Very few people ever recover from it, and once you get it, it's generally a downward spiral until you die, and usually you die a very horrible death because your muscles no longer work. You can't breathe anymore, you can't swallow, you can't speak, and so on. So it's a process that results in degeneration of the central nervous system, and the motor neurons in particular in the brainstem and the cortex die. They actually undergo a death process. And we were mystified, in fact, everybody's been mystified about this particular disease, why this happens. It just so happens that we were studying some of the prison guard families in the Huntsville area, and so we were testing these people, and we tested this family, and they came up positive for a very unusual bacteria called a mycoplasma. And we'd seen a very similar type of mycoplasma, in this case Mycoplasma fermentans, in the Gulf War veterans that came back from the Gulf, including our stepdaughter, and this is how we kind of got involved with this whole problem. But back to the prison story, there were a number of guards and family members who were getting sick, only they were getting sick before the Gulf War, and it corresponded to some vaccine testing programs that were taking place in the prison system in Texas from the late 70s to late 80s. And after that, during that period, these people were becoming sick, and there was quite an epidemic of sickness in Huntsville, Texas. And nobody knew what to do about it. And they complained to the state health authorities, and they came out and checked the river water and said, the river water is clean, it's not contaminated. And they kept saying, no, it's not that, it's the prison. These people that are getting sick are all attached to the prison in one way or another, either in a family or directly as a guard or somebody that works as a clerk or works in the infirmary in the prison. And these were the people getting sick. It didn't have anything to do with the water, but the health department wouldn't have anything to do with it. They just turned their back on these people, and so they were desperate to get some help. Well, we found out that these families were infected with the very same species of mycoplasma that we found in the Gulf War veterans.
Now, was this a genetically altered one? In other words, it's not a regular mycoplasma?
In the case of the prison system, yes, it was. At least we found a lot of different types of changes in the prison system that we didn't find in the Gulf War veterans. We found a genetic change in over half the Gulf War veterans who were positive for mycoplasma fermentans, but that was a single type of change. Whereas in the prison system, we found multiple changes. You know, and again, we weren't sure where this came from. It was only later on that this one family that called me, for example, joined together with what I call the three moms. These were three mothers that, just to show you how three mothers can make a huge difference, because of their illness and seeking questions, started to ask questions up and down the state, and they went and they tried to dig out the records, and most of the records were destroyed on purpose. But they managed to find some in a basement, a dusty basement in Austin, which is the state capital, and sure enough, they found some of the prison records where they had actually approved these tests in the prison system. Of course, over the years, they've been denying this. In fact, they were attacking us and threatening me to close down my laboratory and so on if I continued in this area, and that we were lying about the experiments in the prison system and so on. Well, finally, somebody had the documents. They were the ones lying, not us. And they were lying about this program all along. It all correlated to a period in time when the prison system was literally taken over by the U.S. Army. That is, the main officials in the prison health system were retired colonels of the medical corps and had come from the Army and essentially moved into positions and started these experimental programs in the prison system.
Now,
they denied.
Go ahead.
And people were getting sick, and people were dying, and they were denied people were dying. And I know this was happening because one of the pathologists that I trained went on the faculty at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. And by state law in Texas, the prisoners who died were supposed to go to Galveston to be autopsied at the medical school there, and they weren't getting these prisoners. We knew they were dying. Prison guards were telling us they were dying. People who worked in the infirmary were telling us we were dying, but the prisoners never got to the appropriate place, and we'd heard that they had been shipped to an Army base in Texas outside of San Antonio for autopsy, and then they were sent to a private crematorium that was built for the express purpose of destroying these bodies. So this was the story that was coming to us. We're not private investigators. We're medical investigators. We were only dealing with the medical side of it, and we didn't really know what to do with this story. But since it's gotten out, and now come back to ALS, we found that in this population that we work with, there was an alarming number of ALS patients. In fact, in a four-block area, or a two-block area, there were four people in Huntsville alone, which is a small community of about 35,000, that had ALS. And, of course, the normal incidence of ALS is about 1 in 100,000 people, and all of a sudden in this small community, you've got a huge number of cases. And then, now, going to San Antonio, Kelly Air Force Base, all of a sudden, there are about 130 cases of ALS on this one Air Force Base. And, you know, there would have to be in the normal population over 130,000 people if you expected that number of ALS cases. And here was a base, maybe there were 15,000 people or something max at this base. So there was a huge increase in the incidence of this autoimmune neurodegenerative disease, ALS. So some reason, something was behind this. There had to be some reason why all these people were coming down with ALS in Huntsville, at Kelly Air Force Base, and other areas. And there's certain hotspots for ALS around the country, only you'll never hear about it from the Department of Defense. You'll never hear about it from the VA or any health department. It's, you know, only these things happen, that is, information happens by accident. Whereas somebody starts to tally up the number of ALS cases and said, well, wait a minute, why are we having all these cases in these communities? And the same thing is true with multiple sclerosis, or MS. Same thing is true with certain autoimmune diseases. All of a sudden you find them in communities, in hot spots, where the incidence is extremely high. These are called clusters, where you have an incidence of illness that's not expected. So most people consider that if you find a cluster, and there's a huge increase in the rate of a disease in that area where you find the cluster, then there has to be something environmental that's wrong with that area in order for the clusters to happen, because you can't genetically relate them to these people. you know, all these people in Huntsville were different families. They weren't all the same family. So what is the reason for it? And that's why we started investigating this, because just by accident we found in some of the families there were ALS patients, and they all tested positive. So recently we did a study. This was a joint study with the group in the United Kingdom, in England, that was doing work on ALS in not only in British Gulf War veterans, but in the general population. So we started studying those, comparing them to people in the United States in these clusters. And we found exactly the same thing. In Gulf War veterans from Great Britain, Australia, and the United States, 100% of these patients had this mycoplasma. There was only one exception that didn't have mycoplasma fermentans, and that patient had mycoplasma genitalium, a related type of mycoplasma. And then we started looking at the populations in general rather than just the military populations. We found the same thing. 85% of the people that we tested with ALS had evidence of this mycoplasma, and overwhelmingly, there was this one species, Mycoplasma fermentans, although in the civilians they can have other species. They don't have to have Mycoplasma fermentans. We found those in the military and the prison system.
Now, you'd ordinarily see, what, maybe 5% of the population at the most would have this?
Yes, that's correct, and would usually not have any other infection if they had it. Otherwise, they become symptomatic, and that's the other thing that we found. There was not only the infection with the bacteria, but there was a viral infection that went along with it. And the bacteria that we found, like Mycoplasma fermentans, is considered to be a neurotrophic bacteria. That is, it will invade the central nervous system and cause havoc in the central nervous system. In this case, cause cell death in the central nervous system. But it's a double whammy, it looks like, in ALS. They get another type of infection called an enterovirus. It's related to poliovirus. And there's a very specific virus called an ECHO-7 enterovirus that we find, again, in about 85 to 90% of the ALS patients. And you see it scattered about in other types of illness, but not in that high a percentage. In fact, we've never seen such a high incidence of these two infections, and we can't find anything else. So it leads us to believe that these two infections play a very important role in the etiology of ALS.
Now, is this what we call Barr-Epstein virus?
No, it's not. It's related to the poliovirus family.
All right.
So it's a little bit different. But, you know, there were a lot of people that seemed to carry poliovirus around, either from receiving the live Sabin vaccine or, you know, other sorts of things. So in those polio inoculum, the ECHO-7 virus could have snuck in. So that's one way in which we think that people could have actually picked up these types of viruses. And that's, in particular, we think that's probably true of the Gulf War veterans, because most of the illness in the Gulf War veterans is traceable to the vaccines, the multiple vaccines that they received during deployment. And although the government for years has fought against this, denied this, tried to destroy records, tried to prevent anybody from looking at the shot records of individual soldiers, there are certain studies that were done, for example, in Kansas and in England and so on, that point directly to the vaccines, where they study people that received the vaccines and weren't deployed, people who received the vaccines and were deployed, people that didn't receive the vaccines, and the conclusion was, if you got the vaccines, you're at very high risk.
Whether you went to the Gulf or not.
Whether you went to the Gulf or not. So now I think the picture is becoming clear, although there's still a lot of denial going on in Washington that this is it. But I think it's become very clear. Now, it turns out, very interestingly, a study that was done and published in the Journal of Vaccines indicated that 6% of commercial vaccines were actually contaminated with mycoplasmas of various species. So it's not out of the realm of reason to predict that if that's the case, then some of the vaccine lots may be contaminated. Now, again, we were attacked roundly when we put forward this hypothesis that perhaps things like the anthrax vaccine and experimental vaccines that were given during the Gulf War might be the cause of Gulf War illness. Oh, boy, did we run into a lot of trouble because of that. But it turns out the company that makes the anthrax vaccine, a company called Bioport, based in Michigan, has such a sloppy record. Matter of fact, it's in the paper today, you may have noticed, they've just allowed it to reopen after years of being shut down for violations. The FDA would not let them sell their vaccine to the military because so many lots failed.
But of course,
they were taking these old lots and redating them. And then they were testing them and finding out that they didn't have the same potency, they were contaminated, they had other problems. And they had so many problems that they shut them down for quite a long period of time.
But didn't an awful lot of our servicemen get that faulty vaccine before the FDA came in?
Well, that's correct, because the lots of vaccine were never FDA approved, even though they claimed they were. In fact, the entire vaccine that they used, called the anthrax vaccine absorbed, or AVA, was never approved by the FDA. It was actually given a waiver by the Division of Biologics at the National Institutes of Health in 1970, before the FDA was actually even looking at vaccines like the anthrax vaccine. So it kind of got grandfathered in. And they claim that it's the same vaccine. They don't dare change it, because if they do change it, then they have to go back to the FDA for approval. So essentially, they've been operating on kind of a waiver, although they do claim that it was approved by the government, although not by the FDA. But there is a lot of questions about this. And when this vaccine, for example, was given to service personnel at Dover Air Force Base, a lot of them became sick. In fact, over half the people that received the anthrax vaccine became ill. Anywhere from 5 to 10% became chronic patients. That is, they had long-term illness of duration more than several months. And the problem is that none of these adverse reactions to the vaccine, the anthrax vaccine, were ever recorded, because of the way the military set these arbitrary limits on recording adverse effects. Somebody had to be sick and miss 48 hours, be hospitalized, or so on, before they were ever recorded as having an adverse effect from the anthrax vaccine. And, of course, the reporting period didn't last very long, so people who became sick later on were excluded from study. So when you start looking at the ways that they've jury-rigged the whole process of vaccine surveillance, it's no wonder that so many people have gotten out of the armed services and have refused and even risked courts martial not to take that vaccine. And there's some very prominent Air Force officers, for example, that refused the anthrax vaccine. A lot of these were reserve officers who make their living by flying commercial airlines around the world, and they couldn't take the chance of, they felt, of taking the anthrax vaccine and becoming sick and losing their livelihood. So it was quite a problem for a while, and it's still a problem. They suspended the program for a while, and now they're trying to reinstitute it. And so I think we're going to have the same problem all over again.
All right. Now, of course, some of these mycoplasm are actually a different mycoplasm. Mycoplasm ordinarily occurs, but something's been done to alter it?
Well, you know, there are about 100 different species or more of mycoplasma. Some of these are in the normal flora. For example, in our mouths, in our oral cavities, for example, in our gut, and so on. And so mycoplasma per se is not necessarily dangerous. It's the pathogenic mycoplasma that are dangerous. And, you know, one of the things that recently I testified to Congress on this issue, and people from the VA were trying to say that, well, these mycoplasma aren't dangerous. You know, they're part of the normal flora. Well, these are not part of the normal flora. And certainly, even if they're in the normal flora, that doesn't mean that they're dangerous until they actually get in your body. And we use blood tests to find these. We don't just take swabs from the mouth, for example, to test for these things. So we know that they're inside. If you have bacteria in your blood, that's not a good sign. So when we find these in the blood, we consider that they're in a systemic situation. That is, they're system-wide. They're throughout the body. In fact, studies that have been done even at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology have shown that people who get sick from these infections literally have these bugs in every tissue that they bother to sample, including the brain.
Now, of course, doesn't the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology actually have a patent on a specific type of mycoplasma?
Yes, they do. They actually hold the patent on Mycoplasma fermentans, which is a very pathogenic mycoplasma. And for years they denied it was even pathogenic, but the U.S. Army held the patent on it. And the title of the patent was Pathogenic Mycoplasma, and the patent goes on to describe experiments that relate to the pathogenicity of the mycoplasma. So they publicly deny this, but privately they hold the patent on it.
And in that patent, which I've read, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it says that you see this in, what, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, AIDS, and some other disease?
Yes, absolutely. It says it right in the patent.
Sure.
And, of course, then the people that actually are credited with the patent like Dr. Shai-Ching Lo, later on had to deny, for example, that you see this infection in chronic fatigue syndrome patients or Gulf War illness patients. But the tests that they used were so poor that it wasn't very believable. It's almost like they were put up to do some tests, and they did them, and they did them very poorly, and they got a negative result, which is what they wanted to get. And so they said, no, they're not involved.
But they said this was in all AIDS cases, wasn't that?
It's a very high percentage of HIV.
Right.
So there's an inconsistency there, because they claim that, well, in certain clinical situations like HIV/AIDS, you can find this infection, but you can't find it in other situations. Well, we think that's a lot of hogwash, because using highly specific, highly sensitive molecular tests, we find it present in about 60% of chronic fatigue syndrome patients and fibromyalgia syndrome patients, a closely related syndrome where muscle pain and soreness is a principal complaint. These patients actually do very well if you treat these infections. Some of them actually fully recover, over half of them fully recover from their illness. And for years they've been denying that if you treat these infections, you'll gain any benefit at all. Well, we have thousands of patients now that have gained a lot of benefit from treating these infections, although officially the government still denies this. In fact, they're still putting out propaganda against this. And at the recent hearings in Washington, and I was there too testifying to Congress, one of the head people in the VA actually testified that there was no relationship between these infections and illness in patients seen at the VA. And I know that study quite well, and that study is fatally flawed, and they will take a fatally flawed study and then tout it around because they spent $3 million on it as being something that's very important and crucial to understanding this process. So we've had to do battle with the VA and the Department of Defense before, so we know that we know their angle, and we know what they'll do anything, really, to protect their turf, and this is their turf.
Now, I think the important thing for our listeners to understand is that they will rig these studies because they don't want the information to come out, and we've seen this, and those of you who listen to our programs regularly will recall we've talked about this with a number of other treatments or for various other diseases. So here we have the VA doing a study with Gulf War illness to find out if the mycoplasm is involved, and you feel that this was not a fair test at all?
Well, actually, diagnostically, they found exactly what we published, and they couldn't screw that up, because it turned out there was a very reputable scientist who was involved in the diagnostic part of the study, and it was done at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and he was a mycoplasma expert, Professor Joel Baseman, and he found exactly what we had published, that about 40% of the veterans had this infection. And of those who were positive, more than 80% were positive with the mycoplasma fermentans. That's almost exactly what we published previously. And two other laboratories have now confirmed that as well. So there are three other labs besides their own that have gotten the same results. What the VA did was take our preliminary treatment studies and turn that into a clinical trial. And recently now they've denied that there's any relationship between these infections and illness or recovery from illness. And we were getting preliminary reports that a lot of people were doing better in the trial, and then now all of a sudden they're not. So, the whole thing is very dubious to me. Both my wife and I think that they purposely sabotaged the clinical trial, and we actually put that on our internet site, which is www.immed.org. So those of you that are interested not only in this, but in finding out more about infections in chronic fatigue syndrome and autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, MS, ALS, and so on, that we'll hopefully get into our discussions, they can find information on our website.
Let's give that website just one more time.
www.immed.org. It's like immediate.org.
All right, and let's get your telephone number out, too, because certainly if you're out there and you have chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, and they've gone from doctor to doctor, and everybody sort of shrugs and says, oh, well, maybe we ought to have you see a psychiatrist. Why, certainly there's an excellent packet for your doctor, and one for the general population and one for physicians. So how do they get that?
Well, they can either go on the website and virtually all that information is downloadable as HTML documents from our website in different categories, autoimmune diseases, chronic fatiguing illnesses, Gulf War illnesses, chronic infectious disease. There are a number of different areas of the website they can go to get information, or they can write to us at the Institute for Molecular Medicine at 15162 Triton Lane in Huntington Beach, California, 92649. You can get the address from the station probably after the broadcast, or they can call us at 714-903-2900. That's 714-903-2900. And there's a fax back capability if they call, and we can also send them information via U.S. mail.
All right. Now, a couple of intriguing things. First of all, you started out talking about this girl from Huntsville, ALS. She was just a teenager at the time, and she was told she wouldn't live more than a couple of years. Is she still living?
Yes, she is. In fact, after she fully recovered with our assistance, she went on to college. She's now married. She has two children, expecting the third. Her husband is in the Air Force. She just came back from Germany, actually. And that's why her mom called, because she was just there, and her children are healthy. Her family's completely healthy now. And so this was somebody that went from virtually a death sentence to doing very well. We have other people like that. Not everyone is so fortunate, because sometimes people come to us when they're on their deathbed, particularly patients with ALS, for example, or MS or other diseases, when they get to almost a fatal course for their illness. It's really very difficult to reverse it when there's so much permanent damage. But if we can get patients at an earlier stage, we can really help them.
Now, of course, you do have some sort of an ongoing clinical study in Southern California with ALS cases and then, of course, MS cases. But your best results really are with the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, or commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. How well are you doing with those?
Well, our preliminary trial, we did a small pilot trial, and we're now trying to get some funding to improve that. It's difficult convincing neurologists, though, that just simply want to follow ALS patients until they die, that there is something that's useful, that's potentially useful for them. So we're trying to slowly convince them. We have some papers coming out in neurologic journals to hopefully try and turn the tide and convince neurologists that there is something here. We've had a lot of interest from overseas. Gee, within the last week, I've gotten several inquiries from Sweden and Norway and Denmark, and for some reason in Scandinavia, maybe it's because of the publicity, because it's been written up over there and it's been on the television over there, there's a lot of interest. And so we're giving people the trial information, and I'll just repeat what happened in the brief trial that we did, an 8-week trial, which is not a very long period of time. We saw objective increases in muscle strength from 20% to 40% in patients. There were some patients who couldn't walk and then could get up and actually walk, and couldn't swallow, could regain the ability to swallow, regain the ability to talk. So we saw some pretty dramatic changes, but we have to follow up on that.
All right, fine. We're going to be about 3 minutes, and so if you'd like to get a cup of coffee or a drink of water, why don't you go for it? Then we'll be right back here with Dr. Garth Nicholson. Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that we are listener-supported. We're dependent upon you for what we do, and we hope that many of you out there will decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. More. Now, why should you want to support us? Well, we do 5 hours of talk radio a day. We do 2 programs on Saturday. We reach that program. A Saturday program reaches 14 different stations, and we have an organized effort to try to bring you the news that you're not going to get elsewhere. That's our purpose. Why is this important? Because people are dying of ALS. They're dying of many of these chronic degenerative diseases. And unfortunately, the average doctor has never heard of any of these treatments. And I'm not criticizing the doctors. I've been a doctor. I love doctors. I still associate with them on a regular basis. I practiced orthopedics for 40 years, 35 years right where I'm living right now, from 1960 to 1995. But I also know that there are a lot of things that you're never allowed to hear. You never hear a lot of these things discussed. at an orthopedic meeting. Orthopedics are interested in the surgical aspects of what's going on. But there is an organized effort to keep a lot of this information from being widely known, because the experiments that were done on with mycoplasm were in violation of all laws, both international and, of course, moral laws. You're not supposed to experiment on people, the prisoners, without their consent. And, of course, when it gets from the prisoners into the community in Huntsville and then across the nation, and there are a million, between 800,000 and a million people sick with chronic fatigue syndrome, how would they feel if they had an idea that maybe that this was an experiment that somehow went wrong? We can perhaps get into some of that in the next period, but Radio Liberty is going to bring you all sorts of things you're never going to hear elsewhere. I've checked Dr. Nicholson out very carefully before I've asked him to come on, and he's not an infrequent visitor and guest on our programs. We've gone to the medical library and gone through his articles and talked to his students and people who've worked with him, and he is certainly acknowledged throughout the world as an expert in his field. But yet, of course, he got into real trouble because he began to look behind the veil and began to find some of the secrets that nobody's supposed to find out about, and that's why, of course, we will bring you these stories as long as God gives us a microphone and the opportunity. So if you'd like to become part of our team, if you think that it's worthwhile trying to get the truth out across America, if you think that we are truly involved in a battle against really people who have a different agenda, a different view of the world, a different view of right and wrong, if you agree with me that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and medical and ideological battlefield, give us a call. Help us. And remember the telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson at the Institute for Molecular Medicine, and his information really is fascinating because, of course, as he said, there's really nothing that doctors can do for ALS other than, of course, watch them die. And how? What sort of results have you had as far as multiple sclerosis is concerned?
What we haven't had is a regular clinical trial that's been done. So most of the studies are anecdotal, where patients have benefited quite dramatically from treatment of their infections. And I think, again, what most neurologists and rheumatologists that see these sorts of patients don't realize is that there can be an infectious basis for these diseases. Or at least it's considered to be a comorbid condition, which means that it goes along with the illness. We know there's a genetic element to these illnesses, so it's not all explainable by simple infection. So you have to have a predisposition, as it's called, genetic predisposition for these sorts of illnesses. But there are evidently a lot of people that have these predispositions, so then it takes another trigger, and we think these infections might be the trigger that they might get together. And I think the interesting thing that we're finding out now is it's often not just one infection. There seem to be multiple infections. And recently I went down to Australia, and actually I have to go back to Australia. I was a keynote speaker at the International Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Conference there at the end of the year. And essentially we reported on the fact that in chronic fatigue syndrome, there are multiple infections involved. It's not just one infection. There are both viral and bacterial infections. Somewhat similar story that I just talked about in terms of ALS, only different, slightly different types of infections. Yes, the mycoplasma seems to be involved in the majority of patients. Not a polio type virus, but there's another virus of the herpes family that seems to be involved as well, one called human herpes virus 6. So in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, there's also the mycoplasmas, and then there's this other type of virus that seems to be involved, and occasionally you find other bacteria as well, like chlamydia, for example. Chlamydia pneumoniae goes along with some patients. So you could have other bacterial and viral infections, and the same thing is true with fibromyalgia syndrome. MS is a slightly different story, again, slightly different types of infections, but also involving these different mycoplasmas, at least the pathogenic mycoplasmas. That's one of the common denominators we've seen in a number of illnesses, including rheumatoid arthritis and some of the other autoimmune diseases. Majority of patients have these infections. So it's not necessarily found in every patient, but again, a very high percentage of patients have the infections. And we consider that to be important. And also when patients are treated for their infections, they tend to gain tremendously in terms of their health, and some of them actually, in many cases, more than half of them recover from these conditions, which totally amazes rheumatologists, neurologists. They don't believe it when we tell them, well, people treated for rheumatoid arthritis, for example, can totally, some of these can totally recover from these illnesses. But yet there's actually an NIH clinical trial using the type of antibiotics that we've recommended, where a lot of patients gain tremendous benefit from use of these sorts of treatments. But again, this is something that's held back from mainstream medicine. Why it's held back, I can't tell you. But there's a lot of interesting information out there, as you said yourself, that is not getting widely spread through the population. It's relegated to the backwater.
And that's why we do what we do. Now, one of the interesting things, and I'm going to ask my caller who's hoeing on the line just to hang on for a few minutes, one of the interesting things is that the vast majority of people with HIV, which, of course, is the precursor of AIDS, will have a mycoplasma infection. They'll also have an HIV infection. What's the relationship, and is there something, are there several factors associated with HIV, do you think?
Well, there's certainly more than one factor. It's not just the HIV virus, because everybody from Magic Johnson to other people are HIV positive, but yet don't or haven't come down yet with the AIDS complex. And that's where we think the other infections come in, because they actually cause the morbidity or the illness in patients. And in fact, Professor Luc Montagnier from the Pasteur Institute in Paris was the first one to really propose that HIV/AIDS really involved the mycoplasma as a cofactor
right. In
the AIDS process. And so that wasn't really our theory. That was his theory for HIV/AIDS. And I think he's right about that, although there's been a lot of denial on that particular point. But HIV-positive patients can have a number of different types of infections in addition to mycoplasma. They have a full range of different types of infections, and this is really what kills them.
Well, of course, Dr. Gallo said the cofactor was this herpes 6 that you're talking about. And so there seem to be, a number of cofactors all tied into these new diseases that we've never seen before.
Absolutely, and the more you get involved in this, the more you find the fact that patients that have chronic conditions often have chronic infections that underlie these conditions. And, we've got a very rather large segment of our population. I'm not sure the exact numbers, but they're in the tens of millions of people in our country that have these types of diseases, from the chronic fatiguing illnesses that I mentioned to the autoimmune diseases and so on. You start adding all this up, and it's actually quite a dramatic number.
It really is, and it's really rather frightening, as we see, even though we, in many respects, we've stamped out an awful lot of diseases, we seem to have developed all sorts of new diseases.
Well, there's a policy of denial going on, too. I mean, if you called up, for example, the CDC or the NIH and asked them about these diseases, for example, the CDC has been charged with removing funds for illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome and sending them elsewhere. And so it's as if they're purposely avoiding doing any research in this area, trying to do anything about the problem, or even admitting that there is a problem.
Well, for our listener out there, let me suggest a book on chronic fatigue. It's called Osler's Web by Hilary Johnson. Are you acquainted with that book at all?
Yes, I am.
What did you think about that? Of course, they weren't getting at the mycoplasma. They thought it was a viral disease. But as I read that book, I just felt sick inside, realizing that here Congress is appropriating money for one purpose, and the CDC is intentionally and maliciously doing everything they can to block any effective studies.
Well, not only that, I mean, not only do they take the funds, which is, again, a misappropriation, and put it in other areas, but they've actively tried to propagate the idea that things like chronic fatigue syndrome are somatoform disorders. That is, it's all in your head. It's a mental condition caused by stress or other things that has nothing to do with the sorts of things that we've been discussing. But, you talk with these patients as much as we do, and yes, some patients can have mental problems that could underlie their conditions or exacerbate their conditions. But you can't blame that on all these different patients that have problems, and a lot of these are very prominent people that never had any mental illness before, and no history in the family and so on, have slowly come down with these chronic conditions, and now they're being told they're a mental case.
And, of course, you can't be up for more than 2 hours at a time, and you can't think, hey, pretty soon you become a mental case. But it's secondary, not primary.
Well, that's right, because some of the things that go along with it, if you have an infection that invades the central nervous system, things like cognitive problems, mood changes, depression, severe headaches, all these things go along with this whole physiologic process. So it's not just a psychological process. It's a real medical, physiological, organic process that's going on.
Amen to that. Well, let's go see what Mike's patiently hanging on here. Mike, did you have a question or comment?
A question. I want to ask Dr. Nicholson if he has or knows of any research on the long or short-term effects of LSD.
No, I don't. It's interesting that you bring this up because we've had a little bit of an interest in the role that psychotropic drugs might play in exacerbating some of these problems.
And you're talking about the psychiatric SSRIs?
Yes. Mostly because we've had to deal with the fact that a lot of people get put on antidepressants and so on. In some cases, this actually worsens the condition if you have a chronic illness. And so we've tried to tell people that, look, a lot of these drugs aren't going to help you. They may even keep you sick. In some cases, by masking the symptoms. In other cases, by actually suppressing your immune system or doing other things that are not of benefit to your physical condition. And so you need to weed yourself off of dependency on some of these drugs.
Have you had any focus on Xanax, for example?
Well, as a matter of fact that you bring this up, things like Zoloft and Xanax and so on, these antidepressants, we take kind of a dim view of the overuse or overprescription of these types of drugs to treat chronic illnesses. Yes, people that have these chronic illnesses can be depressed. That's quite natural. I've had this myself. You can get depressed just because you're sick and you can't do the things you normally feel that you ought to be able to do. That'll make anyone depressed. But it really wasn't the process of having a mental disease. When you're physically sick, you can have these mental problems that have a physiologic basis rather than a psychological basis. So, and again, once these infections are treated, in the case we've been discussing, all this tends to go away.
Do you know of anybody that's done any research into the long-term effects of LSD?
No, we haven't really gotten involved in that because, that was a drug that during the 60s became prominent because of its misuse. But, you hear about it sporadically, but not a lot.
Okay, thanks so much, Mike. Okay. And, Chris, I'd like to touch on some of the clusters of chronic fatigue syndrome because I know you've looked into that. And we know there was one up in Klein Village, there was one up in Shasta. And these are areas that where you see a whole flock of people with these bizarre diseases. Now, we never saw or recognized chronic fatigue until the early 80s, was probably around sometime before that. But suddenly in Klein Village, there's just a fair number of them there. So what is this idea that there are these clusters, and what are the results that you've got when you've tested and treated the people?
Well, in the case of Incline Village, the patients that have come to us have pretty much all tested positive for mycoplasmal infections. They may have other things as well, but that group of chronic fatigue syndrome patients that come to us, for example, has benefited greatly from antibiotic therapy and immune supplements and vitamins and so on and so forth. It's not just a matter of treating the infections. We do spend a lot of attention on the immune system, and keeping the immune system strong really requires people have the correct diet. So we start with diet. It's very important. And in fact, on our website, there's some information on diets that are important. It goes from diets and the proper nutrients and so on to vitamins and minerals, and then starts to, other supplements that can be used. Some of these are remedies. Some of these are natural immune enhancement agents to build back your immune system, because your immune system is very important in fighting disease, particularly if you have these chronic infections. So we know that just simply giving somebody antibiotics or antivirals is not enough. You really have to build their immune system up, because you've got to get them off of those drugs as soon as possible get them to more natural ways of controlling these infections.
And then, of course, you're using one of the doxycycline type of drug, tetracycline, which really, you're talking really on almost a six-month treatment of, with that, aren't you?
Well, most of the treatments have to be long-term because the types of chronic infections, and the reason they're called chronic infections is because they're generally slow-growing. They're smoldering infections that just require long-term treatment. If we had very rapidly moving infections that spread like wildfire, we could knock them out if they were viral with antivirals or bacterial with antibiotics. But because they're not, because they're slow-moving, smoldering infections, it just requires long-term treatment.
Now, of course, one of our callers called in, and they wanted to know what a mycoplasm was. You and I know, but would you mind describing this? Because for the average individual out there, they know what a bacteria is. At least they think they know what it is, and they have sort of an idea what a virus is. But what's a mycoplasm?
Well, mycoplasma is simply a bacteria without a cell wall. Most bacteria have this rigid polysaccharide cell wall that surrounds them and makes them quite rigid, and they're quite survivable out in the wild with this coating around them. The mycoplasma does not have that coating at all, and the more pathogenic ones slip inside the cells very quickly. They have a membrane around them. They sneak inside the cells, and they stay and hide from the immune system inside cells. And when they're inside the cells, they start stealing metabolites. They steal structures from the cell. For example, they start ripping the lipids out of the mitochondria for their own use, and it can make the mitochondria, which is our little energy, our little battery inside our cells, it makes it leaky, and then they start running down, and it's almost like taking the insulation off a battery. The battery will run down, and same thing with our mitochondria. You take the insulation off of them, their lipids are their insulation. They start to run down. They start to lose their electrical power, and then they can't generate the energy. And all of a sudden, if you take this system wide, you're fatigued. You have no energy anymore. Your cells are run down because the mitochondria inside the cells, perhaps, are run down. So there's some real biochemical reasons that these events occur, and the reasons why we have the final end point that we see in the patient in terms of their signs and symptoms.
All right, now we've talked before. There's certain of these that are different than other mycoplasm. Isn't there one of them that you've uncovered that has a molecule on it that is very similar to something seen on the HIV virus?
Well, what we found in the prison system and also in the Gulf War veterans was a mycoplasma that we said was modified, although we've been severely and bitterly attacked on this point, because nobody wants to admit this. We found a piece of the HIV-1 envelope gene, which is the gene that encodes the surface coating of the HIV virus, and that surface coating, the component that we found, the envelope component, is important in the viral entry into the cells. And so we reasoned that if the mycoplasma has this particular gene or a portion of this gene, that perhaps it's more pathogenic because it gets in the cells easier. And sure enough, Mycoplasma fermentans just zips inside cells compared to other types of microorganisms. So that probably plays other roles too, besides just getting inside cells. It plays a role in terms of other properties that make it important and pathogenic.
Now, of course, I assure that one reason you're attacked for this is because this would be very embarrassing to get out that they produced or somebody produced this, and now it's out in the general community infecting large numbers of people.
Well, it's almost like the Lyme disease story. Very suspicious origin for Lyme disease. You know, this is a tick-borne disease that started in old Lyme, Connecticut, and all of a sudden it's spread all over the East Coast and now on the West Coast, and it's caused by another type of bacteria called Aspergillus. But again, that's a disease that involves co-infections. And we did a study, and also another laboratory has joined in with us back east, and we found that the overwhelming majority of these Lyme disease patients have not only the spirochete, the Borrelia bacterium, they also have mycoplasma infections. And they also sometimes have other bacterial infections as well. And, of course, this has all been denied, and in fact, the physicians that even treat Lyme disease as a long-term chronic infection are being attacked by the health departments and so on. And I find this unbelievable myself, but it is going on. And we don't know why this is happening, and people are thinking, you know, I'm just here trying to treat this illness in the community and everything, and I'm being attacked for it.
I know. Well, they even had a big picture of you in our local newspaper, and they were talking about all the money you were making. I know you're not getting rich at all in what you're doing. You're simply trying to help people. But, you know, I saw that in the paper, and I thought, you know, anytime you try to do what's right, you can be... what's that old saying? No good deed will ever go unpunished.
Well, if I think we're making a lot of money on what we're doing, that's a laugh, because we've poured in almost our life savings into helping people, and so I find that particularly amusing.
Well, I do too, but you know, as I read that, if I got mad every time I see something that I know is an outright lie, I'd be mad all the time. You got to learn how to smile through clenched teeth. Right now, let's go to Rose, who's calling us from New York. Hi, Rose. How are you doing?
Hi. I may be incorrect, if one of these bacteria, the mycoplasms, break down urea or use that, and if so...
Well, there is another mycoplasma that's called a uroplasma that seems to be involved in the metabolism of urea, and that's where it gets its name. But most of the mycoplasma that we work with are, you know, they're... It's not a big characteristic that they have.
Well, I was wondering if there's been any study as far as diet, whether you're more susceptible if you were on a high carbohydrate diet or a high protein diet or anything like that.
Absolutely. In fact, I go into this on our website. I mean, one of the things that we found is that if you're on a high sugar diet, this is the worst possible thing in the world. First, the high sugar diet is suppressing your immune system, and I know myself, I'm very sensitive to this. If I go on high sugar, I know my immune system is depressed, because it just happens, and all of a sudden, you know, herpes infections come out that I haven't had for years and so on. A lot of people are like this, not everyone, but a lot of people are like this. So we know that we have to reduce the processed sugar in the diet. We have to increase the vegetables in the diet, the natural foods and so on, increase the vitamin and mineral intake of the appropriate type and so on. All this is discussed, by the way, on the website. In fact, there's an article that I put in the Townsend Letter, and there's another article out in the Journal of the American Nutraceutical Society on diet, on what needs to be done to correct our diets, because here in the United States we have very terrible diets.
Okay, Rose, we've got another call. Anything else quick?
No, that's fine.
Thanks so much. Good to hear from you. And we've got Theodora calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Theodora.
Hi, Dr. Fannin. Hi, Dr. Nicholson. I followed you for many years, and I recommend your website almost weekly to people who are dealing with these illnesses. And my question is about, have you worked with any of the natural antibiotics like oil of oregano or the olive leaf extract or colloidal silver in terms of attacking these infections?
The first two, absolutely. In fact, they're recommended on our website. And we try and get people off antibiotics as soon as possible and on these more natural remedies and immune enhancement agents and so on and so forth. It's very, very important, I think, that people don't misuse things like antibiotics. They're for many patients, are very important to first use them to suppress the infection. Once the infections are suppressed, then there are other things that can be used to maintain patients. So for maintenance, for sure. In some cases, patients have actually done very well on some of these natural remedies, two you just mentioned that we recommend. We haven't had as good a luck with colloidal silver as some people claim, so I'm hesitant to recommend that at all, just from our experience. But the other two, for sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and let's see, we've got Dan calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Dan. A quick question. We're just about out of time.
Thank you for letting me ask a question. My wife is a dental hygienist, and I'm calling for her. And she was asking me if there are possibly a connection between the hepatitis B vaccine and this chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. Also, is it possible? How contagious is it? This mycoplasm. She's a hygienist, and was a hygienist, and she's constantly working, right in people's faces.
Now, I've heard a lot of dental hygienists get chronic fatigue. Is there any truth to that, doctor?
Well, as far as we know, there is. In fact, I was just asked, and I'm going up in March to present to the American Academy of Biological Dentistry at their annual meeting. These are mostly oral surgeons, and people are involved in treating oral infections. And, of course, this is a very important oral infection. We consider the mycoplasmas to be only moderately contagious. They're not wildly contagious, for example, like influenza virus or something like this, but they can pass. They're an airborne infection. We found in the families of Gulf War veterans, for example, we have a study coming out in the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, that in the majority of these families, these infections can pass. So it seems to require prolonged contact. It's not highly infectious, but it can invade into family members, immediate family members, and we think it also has the potential to penetrate into the workplace. We know that healthcare workers and teachers and so on are at highest risk for these types of chronic infections. So some of it does penetrate.
Dan, we're going to have to let you go. You can get in touch with the website, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, sir, for these good programs.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Well, Dr. Nicholson, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. And, we've got people listening. Rose was from New York, Dan's from Washington. So we got a pretty good cross-section of America. Thank you so much, and I hope I can call on you again in the not-too-distant future.
Oh, absolutely. We love to talk about these topics because you're one of the few forums that we can get this information out to the general public.
Well, that's why I think what we do is important. God bless you. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. All right, that was Dr. Garth Nicholson, and I hope you enjoyed that. For our listeners, Dr. Nicholson is certainly one of the most eminent scientists in the nation. In fact, they have this big picture of him in our local newspaper within his last week, and of course they were sort of scoffing at him. I will tell you that I've followed his career. He's a very, very courageous individual. I've talked to his students when he was, of course, at the MB Anderson Clinic. They loved him. It was sort of like the sun rose and set when what he did. And, of course, as he says, he's attacked not because he's doing anything wrong, because he's trying to save human lives. And we're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we're going to have to bid adieu to our listeners up there in the great Northwest, and we'll be back with you again Monday. And until then, please pray for America, and remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.